family and tribe. But there are many minds wheeling about in the unconscious. During her senior year, Erica found herself unexpectedly sucked back into a maelstrom. She found the primeval callings of home, family, and tribe reaching out and claiming her in ways she never anticipated. The complications started when she applied for early decision to the University of Denver and was accepted. Her SATs weren't quite good enough to earn her admission, but her background helped. When the acceptance letter from Denver arrived, Erica was thrilled, but she was thrilled in a different way than somebody in Harold's social class would have been. Erica's attitude was that she came from a neighborhood where the tough survive and the weak are eaten. For her, Denver admission wasn't a merit badge in honor of her wonderful self. It wasn't a prestigious window sticker her mom could stick on the car. It was the next front in the battle of life. She brought the acceptance letter separately to her mother and to her father. That's when all hell broke loose. You have to remember that Erica had a split background, half Mexican and half Chinese. She had two extended families, and she spent time with each of them. In some ways, both families were the same. People on both sides were ferociously loyal to their kin. When people around the world are asked whether they agree with the statement, "Regardless of the qualities and faults of one's parents, one must always love and respect them," 95% of Asians and 95% of Hispanics say they agree, compared to, say, only 31% of Dutch respondents and 36% of Danes. Both of Erica's extended families would go out for large and long picnics in the parks on Sunday afternoons, and while the food was different, the atmosphere was similar. The grandparents sat in the same sorts of blue folding chairs in the shade. The kids formed little packs. But there were differences. It was hard to put those differences into words. Every time she tried to explain the contrasts between her Mexican and Chinese relatives, she ended up lapsing into stale ethnic clichés. Her father's extended family inhabited a world of Univision, soccer, merengue, rice and beans, pig's feet, and El 16 de Septiembre. Her mother's family inhabited a world of walks, ancestor stories, shopkeeper's hours, calligraphy, and ancient sayings. But the important differences were as pervasive as they were elusive. There were different kinds of messes in the kitchens, different smells that greeted you at the front door. The families told different kinds of jokes about their own kind. Erica's Mexican relatives joked about how late they were to everything. Her Chinese relatives joked about which uncouth cousin spit on the floor. Erica had a different personality depending on what home she visited. With her father's Mexican relatives, she stood closer to people. She was louder. Her arms hung more loosely around her body. With her mother's relatives, she was more deferential. But when it came time to reach across for a serving platter at the dinner table, she was more aggressive. She was a picky eater with her Mexican relatives, but ate the grossest things imaginable with her Chinese ones. In the different contexts, she had different ages. With her father's family, she acted like a fully sexualized woman. With her mother's family, she still acted like a girl. Years hence, after she had finished her education and made her way in the world, she would come back and visit these relatives, and she would immediately slip back into her old girlhood personas. A man has as many social selves as there are individuals who recognize him and carry an image of him in their mind, William James once wrote. The Denver admissions letter created problems at both sets of homes. Everybody in Erica's families was, on one level, thrilled that she had gotten into such a fine school. But their pride was a possessive pride, and beneath their happiness there were layers of suspicion, fear, and resentment that took a long time to unpack. The academy had already opened up rifts between her and her relatives. The school had imparted certain unconscious messages. You are your own project, and your goal in life is to fulfill your own capacities. You are responsible for yourself. Success is an individual achievement. The members of her extended families did not necessarily share these presuppositions. Her Mexican relatives were wary of the changes that had already come over her personality. Like most Mexican Americans, Erica's relatives were assimilating into mainstream American life. By the time they have lived in the United States for 30 years, 68% of Latinos own their own home. By the third generation, 60% of Mexican-American immigrants speak only English in the home. But Erica's Latino relatives had little experience with the world of elite higher education. They suspected, probably correctly, that if Erica went off to Denver, she would never really be one of them again. They had a sense of cultural boundaries. Within their own world, they had their heritage and culture, which was deep, enriching, and profound. Outside the boundaries, they felt there was no heritage. The culture was thin and spiritually inert. Why would anybody want to live on that sparse ground? Erica's Chinese relatives also feared she was about to drift away into some loose, amoral world. They wanted her to succeed, but through the family, near the family, and among the family. They began pressuring her to go to college closer to home, to schools that were less prestigious than Denver. Erica tried to explain the difference. She tried to explain how useful it was to go to a competitive school. They didn't seem to get it. They didn't seem to understand the thrill she felt at the prospect of moving away and striking out on her own. Erica began to realize that though she looked like them and loved them, she perceived the topography of reality in slightly different ways. Scholars like Shinobu Kitayama of Kyoto University, Hazel Marcus of Stanford, and Richard Nisbet of the University of Michigan have spent years studying the different ways Asians and Westerners think and perceive. The core lesson of Nisbet's work is contained in a famous experiment in which he showed pictures of a fish tank to Americans and Japanese and asked them to describe what they saw. In case after case, the Americans described the biggest and most prominent fish in the tank. The Japanese made 60% more references to the context and background elements of the scene, like the water, rocks, bubbles, and plants in the tank. Nisbet's conclusion is that, on the whole, Westerners tend to focus narrowly on individuals taking actions, while Asians are more likely to focus on contexts and relationships. His argument is that, since at least the time of classical Greece, Western thought has emphasized individual action, permanent character traits, formal logic, and clearly delineated categories. For an even longer period, Asian thought has emphasized context, relationships, harmony, paradox, interdependence, and radiating influences. Thus, to the Asian, Nisbet writes, the world is a complex place, composed of continuous substances, understandable in terms of the whole rather than in terms of the parts, and subject more to collective than personal control. This is a wide generalization, obviously, but Nisbet and many other researchers have fleshed it out with compelling experimental results and observations. English-speaking parents emphasize nouns and categories when talking with their children. Korean parents emphasize verbs and relationships. Asked to describe video clips of a complex airport scene, Japanese students pick out many more background details than American students. When shown a picture of a chicken, a cow, and some grass, and asked to categorize the objects, American students generally lump the chicken and the cow because they are both animals. Chinese students are more likely to lump the cow and the grass because cows eat grass and so have a relationship with it. When asked to describe their day, American six-year-olds make 3 times more references to themselves than Chinese six-year-olds. The experiments in this line of research are diverse. When presented with a dialogue of a mother and daughter arguing, American subjects were likely to pick a side, either the mother or daughter, and describe who was right. Chinese subjects were more likely to see merit in both positions. When asked about themselves, Americans tend to exaggerate ways in which they are different and better than the crowd, while Asians exaggerate the traits they have in common and the ways they are interdependent. When asked to choose between three computers, one of which had more memory, one of which had a faster processor, and one of which was in the middle on both, American consumers tend to decide which trait they value most and then choose the computer with the highest performance on that trait. Chinese consumers tend to choose the middle computer, which has a mid-ranking on both traits. Nisbet has found that Chinese and Americans use different scanning patterns to see the world. When looking at something like the Mona Lisa, Americans tend to spend more time looking at her face. The Chinese eyes perform more saccades, jerky eye movements, between the focal object and the background objects. This gives them a more holistic sense of the scene. On the other hand, separate research has found that East Asians have a tougher time distinguishing fearful from surprised expressions and disgusted from angry expressions because East Asians spend less time focused on the expressions around the mouth. Erica's Mexican and Chinese relatives couldn't have told you how culture influenced them, beyond the vague stereotypes, but they did have a sense that people in their group possessed a distinct way of thinking, that their way of thinking embodies certain values and leads to certain accomplishments. It's spiritual death to leave that behind. Authenticity. Relatives from both sides urged Erica to stay close to home. Any kid in Harold's social class would have shrugged off these pleas. Of course he would go off to college. To people in Harold's circle, personal growth mattered most. But for members of Erica's cultures, family mattered most. Erica found that she was attached to these people in a way that preceded individual choice. Their preconceptions were implanted in her brain, too. Then there were her childhood friends. Many of her oldest friends had rejected the values of the academy. She'd gone down one cultural path, and they'd gone down another, toward gangster rap, tats, and bling. They had decided, consciously or not, to preserve their integrity as outsiders. Instead of selling out to the mainstream culture, they lived in opposition to it. These kids, white, black, brown, and yellow, divided their world into white culture, which was boring, repressive, and dweeby, and black rapper culture, which was glamorous, sexy, dangerous, and cool. Their sense of integrity was more important to them than future income, or else they just didn't want to apply themselves and were rationalizing. In any case, they went down a spiral of countercultural opposition. The way they dressed, the way they walked, the way they sat, the way they acted around adults, all these things made them admired among their peers, but precluded high school success. As a matter of self-respect, they were rude to any adult who might help them. They told Erica she was a fool to go off to that country club where everybody would look down on her. They told her she'd come back to the hood in her pink preppy sweaters and her khaki shorts. They wanted to be rich, but hated the rich at the same time. She knew they were half teasing, but she was more than half upset. In the weeks around graduation, Erica thought about her life. She could barely remember the hours she had spent studying. Her most vivid memories involved hanging out on the street and on the playground, fooling around with her friends, going out on her first dates, getting drunk behind the warehouses, playing double dutch while high at the Boys and Girls Club. She had spent so many hours trying to get away from this place, but she loved it nonetheless, more fiercely, because it was so ugly. The summer after high school graduation should have been a time of ease and celebration, but Erica would forever after remember it as the summer of authenticity. Her friends called her Poindexter, or just Denver, as in, "Hey, here comes Denver. Isn't she late for her foursome?" So, of course, she smoked more weed that summer than ever before. Of course, she hooked up with more guys. Of course, she listened to more Lil Wayne and more Mexican music and did everything to rebut the neighborhood impression that she'd been whitewashed. Things became bad at home with her mother. She'd be out until 3 a.m., sleeping over unannounced at other people's homes, and showing up at noon the next day. Her mother didn't know if she even had the right to control her anymore. The girl was 18, but she worried more than ever. Her dreams for her daughter were suddenly in peril. Something terrible could happen. A shooting, a drug arrest. It was as though the culture of the street had reached out from beyond the grave and was pulling her daughter back in. One Sunday afternoon, Erica came home and found her mother dressed, angry, and standing by the door. Erica had promised to be home early so they could go to a family picnic together, but Erica had forgotten. She got angry when her mother reminded her of it all, and grumpily stormed off to her room to get dressed. "Too busy for me," her mother screamed. "Not too busy for the gangbangers." Erica wondered where her mom got that word. There were about 20 aunts, uncles, cousins, and grandparents at the picnic. They were delighted to see Erica and her mom. Hugs all around. One man handed her a beer, which had never happened before. The picnic was fun. The loud ones talked and talked. Stories were told. As usual, Erica's mom sort of faded into the background. She was the disappointment in the family, and so she was relegated to a silent corner of family life. But she seemed to be following along and soaking up the company. Around about hour three, the older folks were sitting around some tables while the kids were still running around. Some of the uncles and aunts began talking about Denver. They told her about the other kids her age who were going to local colleges. They told her about the Chinese way, the family businesses, the loans that went out from relative to relative. They told her about their own accomplishments and their own lives, and as the minutes passed, they ratcheted up the pressure. "Don't go to Denver. Stay here. The future is bright here." They weren't even subtle. They harangued and pushed. "It's time to come back to your people," an uncle said. Erica looked at her empty plate. "Your family. They can get under your skin in a way no one else can." Tears began to well up in her eyes. Then, a quiet voice could be heard from the other end of the table. "Leave her alone." It was her mother. The picnic table went silent. What followed wasn't even a speech. Her mother was so nervous and yet so furious, she just issued a series of disjointed statements. "She's worked so hard. It's her dream. She has earned the right to go. You don't see her in her room night after night. You don't see how much she has overcome, what has happened at home." Finally, she just looked around at her relatives. "I've never wanted anything so much in all my life for her to go to that place and do this thing." The little speech didn't stop all discussion. The uncles still thought she was wrong, and they still harangued. But the balance of forces had shifted in Erica's head. Her mom had stood up for her in front of the family. Erica's sense of conviction came back to her, and once she had dug into a position, there was no moving her. The club. Leaving was still not easy. Leaving your childhood home is never easy. In 1959, when the writer Eva Hoffman was 13, her family emigrated from Poland to Canada. Poland lingered forever after in the recesses of her mind. "The country of my childhood lives within me with a primacy that is a form of love," she wrote years later. "It has fed me language, perceptions, sounds, the human kind. It has given me colors and the furrows of reality, my first loves. The absoluteness of those loves can never be recaptured. No geometry of the landscape, no haze in the air, will live in us as intensely as the landscapes that we saw as the first, and to which we gave ourselves wholly, without reservation." But Erica did go, and in early September she found herself in a dorm in Denver. Elite universities are great inequality machines. They are nominally open to all applicants regardless of income. They have lavish financial aid packages for those who cannot afford to pay. But the reality is that the competition weeds out most of those who are not from the upper middle class. To fulfill the admissions requirements, it really helps to have been raised in the atmosphere of concerted cultivation. It helps to have had all the family reading time, the tutors, the coaches, and the extracurricular supervision. Denver gave Erica a chance to be around affluent people and to see how they behaved with one another. She learned how they socialized, how they greeted each other, how they slept with each other, what a guy in that culture said when he wanted to get into your pants, and what a girl in that culture said to keep him out. Denver was like a cultural exchange program. She didn't know the phrase when she got there, but at Denver, Erica acquired what the great sociologist Pierre Bourdieu called cultural capital, the tastes, opinions, cultural references, and conversational styles that will enable you to rise in polite society. Actually, it wasn't the student's wealth that shocked Erica and shook her confidence. She found she could easily look down on the guy who wrecked his BMW one day and had his family drop off a Jaguar the next. It was the knowledge. She'd worked hard at the academy to prepare herself for Denver, but some of these kids had been preparing their whole lives. They'd been to where the Battle of Agincourt had taken place. They'd been to China and spent a summer in high school teaching kids in Haiti. They knew who Lauren Bacall was and where F. Scott Fitzgerald went to school. They seemed to get every reference the professors threw out. A professor would make some reference to Mort Saul or Tom Lehrer, and they'd all chuckle knowingly. They knew how to structure papers in ways that she had never been taught. She took a look at those kids and thought about her friends back in the neighborhood who were still working at the mall or hanging out on the street. Her friends back home weren't just 4 years behind these Denver kids. They were forever behind. Erica took econ, poli-sci, and accounting classes. She hung around the business school and sat in when visiting lecturers stopped by. She was very hard-headed and practical. But something bothered her about these classes. In many of them, Erica was taught by economists and political scientists who assumed that human beings are pretty much the same. You put some incentives in front of them, no matter what their cultural differences, and they will respond in predictable, law-governed, and rational ways. This assumption makes social science a science. If behavior is not governed by immutable laws and regularities, then quantitative models become impossible. The discipline loses its predictive value. It's all just fuzzy, context-driven subjectivity. And yet Erica grew up among many people who did not respond in predictable ways to incentives. Many of her friends had dropped out of high school when all the incentives pointed the other way. Many of them made decisions that were simply inexplicable. Or they had not made decisions at all, because they were in the grip of addictions, mental illnesses, or other impulsions. Furthermore, cultural differences simply played too large a role in her life. What really mattered, it seemed to her, was self-interpretation. The way people defined themselves had a huge impact on how they behaved and responded to situations. None of this seemed to have any role in the courses she was taking. So Erica was drawn, despite her well-laid plans, in a different academic direction. She didn't abandon all the pre-MBA-type courses, but she supplemented them. She found herself drawn, of all places, to anthropology. She wanted to study cultures, how they differed, and how they clashed. It was, at first blush, a wildly impractical subject for an aspiring mogul to study. But Erica, being Erica, quickly turned it into a strategic business plan. Her whole life had been about clashing cultures, Mexican-Chinese, middle class, lower class, the ghetto, the academy, the street, the university. She already understood what it was like to merge different cultures. In a globalizing world, this knowledge would probably come in handy. At college, she would learn how some companies created successful corporate cultures and how some failed at this task. She would learn about how global corporations handled cultural diversity. In a business world filled with engineers and finance people, she would know culture. This would be her unique selling proposition. There would always be a market for skills like that. After all, how many female Chinese Chicana workaholics from the ghetto does anybody know? The extended mind. Millions of years ago, animals roamed the earth. As Michael Tomasello has argued, smarter animals, such as apes, are actually pretty good at coming up with innovative solutions to common problems. What they are not good at is passing down their discoveries to future generations. Non-human animals don't seem to have the impulse to teach. You can teach a chimpanzee sign language, but the chimp won't teach sign language to his fellows or to his children so that they might talk to one another. Humans are different. Humans begin life far behind other animals. Humans have a diffuse set of genetic instructions. So when they are born, and for years afterward, they can't survive on their own. As the great anthropologist Clifford Geertz put it, man is an unfinished animal. What sets him off most graphically from non-men, Geertz continued, is less his sheer ability to learn, great as that is, than how much and what particular sorts of things he has to learn before he is able to function at all. Humans succeed because they have the ability to develop advanced cultures. Culture is a collection of habits, practices, beliefs, arguments, and tensions that regulates and guides human life. Culture transmits certain practical solutions to everyday problems. How to avoid poisonous plants. How to form successful family structures. Culture also, as Roger Scruton has observed, educates the emotions. It consists of narratives, holidays, symbols, and works of art that contain implicit and often unnoticed messages about how to feel, how to respond, how to divine meaning. An individual human mind couldn't handle the vast variety of fleeting stimuli that are thrust before it. We can function in the world only because we are embedded in the scaffold of culture. We absorb ethnic cultures, institutional cultures, regional cultures, which do most of our thinking for us. The human race is not impressive because towering geniuses produce individual masterpieces. The human race is impressive because groups of people create mental scaffolds that guide future thought. No individual could build a modern airplane. But modern companies contain the institutional knowledge that allows groups to design and build them. We build designer environments in which human reason is able to far outstrip the computational ambit of the unaugmented biological brain, the philosopher Andy Clark writes. Unlike other animals, he continues, humans have the ability to dissipate reasoning, to build social arrangements that contain the bodies of knowledge. Human brains, Clark believes, are not so different from the fragmented, special-purpose, action-oriented organs of other animals and autonomous robots. But we excel in one crucial respect. We are masters at structuring our physical and social worlds so as to press complex, coherent behaviors from these unruly resources. We use intelligence to structure our environment so that we can succeed with less intelligence. Our brains make the world smart, so that we can be dumb in peace. Or, to look at it another way, it is the human brain plus these chunks of external scaffolding that finally constitutes the smart, rational inference engine we call mind. Looked at that way, we are smart after all, but our boundaries extend further out into the world than we might have initially supposed. Cultures that work. Erica took courses in sociology, psychology, history, literature, marketing, and behavioral economics. Anything she thought might help her understand the shared scaffolding of the human mind. All cultures share certain commonalities stored in our genetic inheritance. Anthropologists tell us that all cultures distinguish colors. When they do, all cultures begin with words for white and black. If the culture adds a word for a third color, it is always red. All humans, for example, register the same basic facial expressions for fear, disgust, happiness, contempt, anger, sadness, pride, and shame. Children born without sight display emotion on their faces the same way as children born with sight. All humans divide time into past, present, and future. Almost all fear, at least at first, spiders and snakes, creatures that threatened their Stone Age ancestors. All human societies produce art. They all disapprove, at least in theory, of rape and murder. They all dream of harmony and worship God. In his book Human Universals, Donald E. Brown lists traits that people in all places share. The list goes on and on. All children fear strangers and prefer sugar solutions to plain water from birth. All humans enjoy stories, myths, and proverbs. In all societies, men engage in more group violence and travel farther from home than women. In all societies, husbands are on average older than their wives. People everywhere rank one another according to prestige. People everywhere divide the world between those inside their group and those outside their group. These tendencies are all stored deep below awareness. But nobody lives in a universal thing called culture. They live only in specific cultures, each of which differ from one another. Plays written and produced in Germany are three times as likely to have tragic or unhappy endings than plays written and produced in the United States. Half of all people in India and Pakistan say they would marry without love, but only 2% of people in Japan would do so. Nearly a quarter of Americans say they are often afraid of saying the wrong things in social situations, whereas 65% of all Japanese say they are often afraid. In their book Drunken Comportment, Craig McAndrew and Robert B. Edgerton found that in some cultures drunken men get into fights, but in some cultures they almost never do. In some cultures, drunken men grow more amorous, but in some cultures, they do not. Researchers from the University of Florida observed couples having coffee in different cities around the world. In London, couples rarely touch each other. In Paris, 110 touches were observed per coffee. In San Juan, Puerto Rico, it was 180. As Nicholas A. Christakis and James H. Fowler report in their book Connected, 10% of working-age Americans report suffering back pain, but 45% of the people in Denmark do, as do 62% of the people in Germany. Some Asian cultures have very low back pain rates, but many people there do suffer from koro, a condition in which men become afflicted by the feeling that their penises are retracting into their bodies. The treatment involves asking a trusted family member to hold the penis 24 hours a day, until the anxiety goes away. If you bump into a man on the street in the American North, the testosterone level in his bloodstream will not rise appreciably. But if you bump into a man on the street in the American South, where a culture of honor is more prevalent, there will probably be a sharp spike in cortisol and testosterone production. Cities in the South are twice as likely to have words like gun in their names. Gunpoint, Florida. Whereas cities in the North are more than twice as likely to have words like joy in their names. A cultural construct like language can change the way people see the world. Gugu Yimithir, an Aboriginal tongue in Australia, is one of the world's geographical languages. People don't say, "raise your right hand," or "step backward." They say, "raise your north hand," or "step east." People who speak geographical languages have amazing orientation senses. They always know which way is north, even in caves. A speaker of the language Tzeltal from Mexico was blindfolded and spun around 20 times. He still had no trouble pointing north, south, east, and west. In this way, culture imprints some patterns in our brains and dissolves others. Because Erica grew up in the United States, she had a distinct sense of when something was tacky, even though she couldn't have easily defined what made it so. Her head was filled with what Douglas Hofstadter calls comfortable but quite impossible to define abstract patterns, which were implanted by culture and organized her thinking into concepts such as sleazeballs, fair play, dreams, wackiness, crackpots, sour grapes, goals, and you and I. Erica learned that a culture is not a recipe book that creates uniformity. Each culture has its own internal debates and tensions. Alasdair MacIntyre points out that each vital culture contains a continuity of conflict, which allows divergent behavior. Moreover, in the age of globalization, cultures are not converging. They seem to be growing farther apart. She also learned that not all cultures are equal. She knew she wasn't supposed to think this. She had been at Denver long enough to know that she was supposed to think all cultures were wonderful and they were all wonderful in their own unique way. But she wasn't some rich kid from a suburban high school. She couldn't afford that kind of bullshit. She needed to know what led to success and what led to failure. She looked at the world and at history, looking for clues and useful lessons she could use. She came across a Stanford professor named Thomas Sowell, who wrote a series of books called Race and Culture, Migrations and Cultures, and Conquests and Cultures, that told her some of the things she needed to know. Erica knew she was supposed to disapprove of Sowell. All her teachers did. But his descriptions jibed with the world she saw around her every day. Cultures do not exist as simply static differences to be celebrated, Sowell wrote. They compete with one another as better and worse ways of getting things done. Better and worse not from the standpoint of some observer, but from the standpoint of the peoples themselves as they cope and aspire amid the gritty realities of life. Erica had noticed that some groups seemed to outcompete their neighbors and peers. Haitians and Dominicans share an island, but the Dominicans have a GDP per capita that is nearly 4 times higher than that of their neighbors. They have life expectancies that are 18 years longer and literacy rates 33 percentage points higher. Jews and Italians both lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan during the first half of the 20th century, but the Jews rose out much more quickly. She noticed that some groups made themselves winners wherever they settled. The Lebanese and the Gujarati Indians became successful merchants in different societies with different conditions all around the world. In Ceylon in 1969, the Tamil minority provided 40% of all university students in the sciences, including 48% of all engineering students and 49% of all medical students. In Argentina, 46% of the businessmen in Who's Who were foreign-born. In Chile, 3/4 of the heads of large industrial enterprises were immigrants or the children of immigrants. In American schools, Chinese-American kids raced ahead. By the time they enter kindergarten, Chinese-Americans are 4 months ahead of Latino children in letter recognition and other pre-reading skills. They take more demanding high school courses than the average American student. They do much more homework each night. They are more likely to be punished at home if they earn a grade lower than an A-. Roughly 54% of Asian Americans between the ages of 25 and 29 have graduated from college, compared to 34% of native-born white Americans. These cultural differences can produce stunning inequalities. Asian Americans have a life expectancy of 87 years, compared with 79 years for whites and 73 years for African Americans. In Michigan, a state with a struggling economy, The Asian American life expectancy is 90, while for the average white person it's 79, and for the average African American it's 73. Income and education levels are also much higher. The average Asian American in New Jersey lives an amazing 26 years longer and is 11 times more likely to have a graduate degree than the average American Indian in South Dakota. Erica also noticed that some cultures are more corrupt than others. In their study, Cultures of Corruption, Raymond Fisman and Edward Miguel took advantage of a natural experiment. Until 2002, diplomats in New York City could avoid parking fines. Fisman and Miguel analyzed the data from 1,700 consular personnel and their families to see who took advantage of their immunity and who didn't. They found that diplomats from countries that rank high on the Transparency International Corruption Index piled up huge numbers of unpaid tickets, whereas diplomats from countries that ranked low on the index barely got any at all. Between 1997 and 2002, diplomats from Kuwait picked up 246 parking violations per diplomat. Diplomats from Egypt, Chad, Nigeria, Sudan, Mozambique, Pakistan, Ethiopia, and Syria also had incredible numbers of violations. Meanwhile, diplomats from Sweden, Denmark, Japan, Israel, Norway, and Canada had no violations at all. Even thousands of miles away from home, diplomats still carried their domestic cultural norms inside their heads. The results were not influenced by salary, age, or any other of the measured controls. Erica noticed, in sum, that certain cultures are better adapted for modern development than others. In one class, she was assigned a book called The Central Liberal Truth by Lauren C. Harrison. People in what he calls progress-prone cultures assume that they can shape their own destiny. People in progress-resistant cultures are more fatalistic. People in progress-prone cultures assume that wealth is the product of human creativity and is expandable. People in progress-resistant cultures have a zero-sum assumption that what exists will always be. People in progress-prone cultures live to work, he argues. People in progress-resistant cultures work to live. People in progress-prone cultures share other values. They are more competitive. They are more optimistic. They value tidiness and punctuality. They place incredible emphasis on education. They do not see their family as a fortress in a hostile world. They see it as a gateway to the wider society. They internalize guilt and hold themselves responsible for what happens. They do not externalize guilt and blame others. Erica became convinced that this cultural substructure shaped decisions and behavior more than most economists or most business leaders realized. This was where the action was. Memo to herself. Late in her college career, Erica opened up her laptop and wrote a memo to herself. She tried to write some lessons or rules that would help encapsulate what she'd learned by studying cultural differences. The first maxim she wrote to herself was, "Think in networks." Society isn't defined by classes, as the Marxists believe. It's not defined by racial identity. And it's not a collection of rugged individualists, as some economic and social libertarians believe. Instead, Erica concluded, society is a layering of networks. When she was bored, she would actually sit down and draw up network charts for herself and her friends. Sometimes she'd put a friend's name in the middle of a piece of paper and then draw lines to all the major attachments in that person's life. And then she'd draw lines showing how strongly those hubs were attached to one another. If she'd gone out with friends the night before, she might draw a chart showing how all the people in the group were socially attached. Erica felt sure she'd understand people better if she saw them linked and in context. She wanted to train herself to think of people as embedded creatures whose decisions emerge from a specific mental environment. Be the glue. Erica wrote next. She would look at her charts of the networks and she would ask herself, what do those lines connecting people consist of? In a few special cases, it's love. But in most workplaces and most social groups, the bonds are not that passionate. Most relationships are bound by trust. Trust is habitual reciprocity that becomes coated by emotion. It grows when two people begin volleys of communication and cooperation and slowly learn they can rely upon each other. Soon, members of a trusting relationship become willing to not only cooperate with each other, but sacrifice for each other. Trust reduces friction and lowers transaction costs. People in companies filled with trust move flexibly and cohesively. People who live in trusting cultures form more community organizations. People in more trusting cultures have wider stock market participation rates. People in trusting cultures find it easier to organize and operate large corporations. Trust creates wealth. Erica noticed that there are different levels and types of trust in different communities, different schools, different dorms, and different universities. In his classic study, The Moral Basis of a Backward Society, Edward Banfield noticed that peasants in southern Italy shared a great deal of trust with members of their own family, but were very suspicious of people outside their kinship boundaries. This made it hard for them to form community groups or to build companies that were bigger than the family unit. Germany and Japan have high levels of social trust, enabling them to build tightly knit industrial firms. The United States is a collective society that thinks it is an individualistic one. If you ask Americans to describe their values, they will give you the most individualistic answers of any nation on the planet. Yet if you actually watch how Americans behave, you see they trust one another instinctively and form groups with alacrity. Erica decided she would never work in a place where people didn't trust one another. Once she got a job, she would be the glue. She would be the one organizing outings, making connections, building trust. She would carry information from person to person. She would connect one worker to another. If everybody around her drew a network chart of their life, she'd be on every one. The final maxim Erica wrote to herself that day was, "Be an idea space integrator." Erica noticed that the greatest artists often combined what Richard Ogle in his book Smart World calls two mental spaces. Picasso inherited the traditions of Western art, but he also responded to the masks of African art. The merging of these two idea spaces created Les Demoiselles d'Avignon and Picasso's fantastic burst of creativity. Erica resolved that she would always try to stand at the junction between two mental spaces. In organizations, she would try to stand at the junction of two departments or fill in the gaps between departments. Ronald Burt of the University of Chicago has a concept he calls structural holes. In any society, there are clumps of people doing certain tasks. But between those clumps, there are holes, places in between where there are no people and there is no structure. These are the places where the flow of ideas stops, the gaps separating one part of a company from another. Erica would occupy space in those holes. She would span the distance from one group of people to another, reach out to discordant clumps and bring their ideas together. In a world of discordant networks and cultures, she would find her destiny and her role. Chapter 10. Intelligence. Erica didn't have to find her way in business. Business found her. Recruiters had been chasing her since her junior year in college all the way through business school, and she fended them off like an heiress in a Victorian novel, carefully guarding herself for the right suitor. She flirted with finance, got serious for a time with a tech company, but eventually decided to start her career with one of the elite consulting firms. The firm gave her a choice. She could join one of what they called the functional capability groups, are one of the clientele industry sector groups. This was no choice at all because she didn't really know what either did. She chose an FCG because somehow it sounded cooler and wound up working for a man named Harrison. 3 days a week, Harrison would gather his team for a meeting about the research projects they were working on. The meetings weren't held around a table with a speakerphone in the middle like an altar, the way normal meetings were. Harrison, with his own quirky ideas, had hired some interior designer to build a different conversation space. Instead, his team sat on low padded chairs in a vast open area that looked like a big living room. The arrangement was supposed to be flexible and allow small groups to huddle, but instead it allowed large groups of men to be mutually avoidant. They'd come in at 10 a.m. and plop their coffees and papers on the floor, sink down into their chairs and subtly adjust them so they were slightly askew. The chairs would be in a rough circle, but each became slightly misaligned, so that one guy would be looking at the window, another guy would be looking at a piece of corporate art on the wall, and a third would be facing the door. The members of the team could go an entire hour without ever making eye contact, even as they were talking together happily and productively. Harrison was about 35, pale, large but non-athletic, and utterly brilliant. "What's your favorite power law?" he asked Erica during one of her first meetings with the unit. Erica didn't really know what one was. "It's a polynomial with scale invariants, like Zipf's law." Zipf's law, Erica was told later, states that the most common word in any language will appear exactly twice as frequently as the next common word, and so on down to the least common. The largest city in any large nation will be twice as populous as the next largest city, and so on down the line. "Or Kleiber's law," another worker chimed in. "Kleiber's law states that there is a constant relationship between mass and metabolism in any animal. Small animals have faster metabolisms, and big animals have slower ones. And you can plot the ratio of mass to metabolism of all animals on a straight line, from the smallest bacteria to the largest hippopotami." The whole room was suddenly aflame with power laws. Everybody but her had their favorites. Erica felt astoundingly slow-witted next to these guys, but happy she'd get to work with them. Every day's meeting was another intellectual fireworks display. They'd plop down into their chairs, lower and lower as their meeting progressed until they were practically horizontal with their bellies sticking up and their wingtips crossed in front of them. And about once a meeting there'd be some brilliant outburst. One day they spent an hour arguing over whether jazz was the best of all possible words to select when you are playing hangman. Suppose Shakespeare plays had titles like Robert Ludlum Thrillers, one of the crew wondered one day. The Rialto Sanction, somebody suggested immediately. The Elsinore Vacillation, another chirped, for Hamlet. The Dunsinane Reforestation, cried another, for Macbeth. These guys had been marked out as geniuses before they could walk. It seemed as though they'd all been whizzes at College Bowl or debate. Harrison once mentioned that he'd dropped out of med school because it was too easy. If somebody mentioned that somebody in another company was smart, he'd ask, "But is he smart like us?" Erica played a little betting game with herself. She allowed herself to eat one M&M for every second that passed between the time Harrison mentioned the name of somebody and the time he noted whether or not they went to Harvard, Yale, or MIT. Then there were the silences. If they weren't having fierce debates about methodologies and data sets, the whole group was perfectly content to sit in silence for seconds and minutes at a time. For urban ethnic Erica, this was torture. She'd sit upright in her own chair, staring at her feet, repeating a mantra silently to herself, "I will not break this silence. I will not break this silence. I will not break this silence." Erica would wonder how these geniuses could sit mutely this way. Maybe it was just that they were mostly men, and the few other women in her group had, over the years, learned to adapt to the male culture. Erica had, of course, grown up with the popular notion that men are less communicative and empathetic than women. And there is plenty of scientific evidence to support that. Male babies make less eye contact with their mothers than female babies. And the higher the testosterone level in the womb during the first trimester of pregnancy, the lower the eye contact level will be. Simon Baron Cohen of Cambridge surveyed the research literature on male communication and feelings and concluded that men are more curious about systems and less curious about emotions. They are, on average, more drawn to rules-based analyses of how inanimate objects fit together. Women are, on average, better empathizers. They do better in experiments in which they are given partial clues and have to guess a person's emotional state. They are generally better at verbal memory and verbal fluency. They don't necessarily talk more than men, but they seem to take turns more while talking. And they are more likely to talk about others, while men are much more likely to talk about themselves. Women are much more likely to seek somebody else's help when they're in a stressful situation. But Erica had been around groups of guys before, and it was not always like this. This culture was peculiar, and it was shaped from the top down. Harrison had turned social awkwardness into a form of power. The more cryptic he became, the more everyone had to attend to him. He ate the same lunch every day, cream cheese and olive sandwiches. As a boy, he'd developed a formula to help him predict the winners of dog races, and now his business was to look out for hidden patterns. "Did you read the footnotes in the company report?" he asked Erica mysteriously after the group had acquired a new client. "They're about to experience a crossover moment." She pored over the footnotes and still had no clue what he was talking about. He studied charts for hour upon hour. Stock prices, annual cocoa production levels, weather patterns, and cotton output. He could be deeply impressive. Clients respected him even if they didn't love him. CEOs were humble in his presence. Everybody believed that Harrison could look at a page of numbers and tell them if they'd be bankrupt or booming 5 years out. Harrison shared this reverential attitude toward his own intelligence. He was certain about many things. Everything, actually. But he was most certain about two propositions. He was really smart. And most people in the world were not. For a few years, Erica enjoyed working with this man, even with all the weirdness attached. She liked watching him talk about modern philosophy. He was avid about bridge. He loved any intellectual game with a fixed set of rules. Sometimes she helped him apply his insights, which were always dazzlingly complex, into the language of everyday reality. But gradually, she began to notice something. The department wasn't doing very well. The reports were brilliant, but the business sucked. New clients would come, but they would rarely last. People would use their services for specific projects, but they never brought the team on board as trusted advisors. It took Erica a surprisingly long time to come to this realization, but once she did, she looked at her group with a different and more critical eye. The meetings went on forever, she realized, but there was little actual debate. Instead, everybody would bring little bits of information that confirmed theories Harrison had concocted years before. Erica felt as though she were watching courtiers bringing candies to the king and then watching him savor them in everybody's presence. Harrison's favorite locution was, "That's all you need to know." He'd make some sharp, pithy observation about a complex situation, and then he'd bark it out. "That's all you need to know." It occurred to Erica that sometimes it wasn't all you needed to know, but the conversation was effectively over. Then there was the model. Many years before, Harrison had had a big success restructuring a consumer bank. He was a legend in the banking community. Now every time a bank came to him, he tried to implant that model. He tried in big banks and little banks, urban banks and rural banks. When he tried to implant that model in different nations, Erica tried to wheel out her cultural expertise. One meeting, she tried to explain the varieties of capitalism approach pioneered by Peter Hall and David Soskus. Different national cultures, she said, have different motivational systems, different relationships to authority and to capitalism. Germany, for example, has tight interlocking institutions like work councils. It also has labor markets that make it hard to hire and fire people. These arrangements mean that Germany excels at incremental innovation, the sort of steady improvements that are common in metallurgy and manufacturing. The United States, on the other hand, has looser economic networks. It is relatively easy to hire and fire and start new businesses. The United States, thus, excels at radical innovation, at the sort of rapid paradigm shifts prevalent in software and technology. Harrison dismissed her with a wave of the hand. Different countries excelled at different things because of different government regulations. Change the regulations and you change the cultures. Erica tried to argue that regulations emerge from cultures which are deeper and longer lasting. Harrison had turned away. Erica was a valuable employee, but she was not smart enough to bother arguing with. Harrison didn't just treat her this way. He treated clients this way, too. He ignored arguments that didn't fit his mental framework. He had his group prepare long presentations in which they presumed to lecture people about the industries they'd spent their whole lives mastering. They made presentations deliberately opaque as a way of demonstrating their own expertise. They didn't understand that different companies have different risk tolerances. They didn't understand that a particular CFO might be in a power struggle with a particular CEO, and they should be careful not to make the latter's life more difficult. There was no piece of office politics so obvious that they couldn't be oblivious to it. No attempt at empathic accuracy they could not fail. For Erica, no day was complete unless Harrison and his team had committed some incredible faux pas. She spent the final 5 months of her tenure at the firm going home each day with one question on her mind. How could people who are so smart be so fucking stupid? Beyond IQ. This turns out to be a revealing question. Harrison had built an entire lifestyle and career around reverence for IQ. He generally hired people on the basis of intelligence, socialized with people on the basis of intelligence. He impressed clients by telling them he'd unleash a team of Ivy Leaguers on their problems. And to some extent, Harrison's faith in intelligence was justified. Researchers have studied IQ pretty extensively over the decades and know a lot about it. The IQ scores a person gets in childhood are reasonably predictive of the scores he or she gets as an adult. People who are good at one kind of intellectual skill tend to be good at many others. People who are really good at verbal analogies tend to also be good at solving math problems and reading comprehension, though they may be less good at some other mental skills, such as memory recognition. The ability to do well on these sorts of tests is significantly influenced by heredity. The single strongest predictor of a person's IQ is the IQ of his or her mother. People with high IQs do better in school and in school-like settings. As Dean Hamer and Peter Copeland note, in study after study, IQ is the single best predictor of school performance. If you want to lead a business, it probably helps to have an IQ over 100. If you want to go into nuclear physics, it probably helps to have an IQ over 120. But there are a couple of problems with Harrison's emphasis on IQ. In the first place, it is surprisingly malleable. Environmental factors can play a huge role in shaping IQ. A study of black children in Prince Edward County, Virginia, found that they lost an average of 6 IQ points for every missed year of school. Parental attention also seems to matter. Firstborns tend to have higher IQs than secondborns, who tend to have higher IQs than thirdborns. This effect disappears, however, when there is more than a 3-year gap between children. The theory is that mothers talk to their firstborns more and use more complicated sentences. They have to divide their attention when they have young children born closely together. The broadest evidence of IQ malleability is the Flynn effect. Between 1947 and 2002, IQ levels across the developed world rose steadily by about 3 percentage points per decade. This was found across many countries, across many age groups, and in many different settings, and it's stark evidence of an environmental component to IQ. Interestingly, scores did not rise across all sections of the IQ test. People in 2000 were no better at the vocabulary and reading comprehension portions of the test than people in 1950. But they were much better at the sections designed to measure abstract reasoning. Today's children, James R. Flynn writes, are far better at solving problems on the spot without a previously learned method for doing so. Flynn's explanation is that different eras call forth different skills. The 19th century society rewarded and required more concrete thinking skills. Contemporary society rewards and requires more abstract thinking skills. People who have a genetic capacity to reason abstractly use those skills more and more, and hence get better and better at them. Their inherited skills are multiplied by their social experiences, and the result is much, much higher IQ scores. However, once you get beyond the school environment, it's not a very reliable predictor of performance. Controlling for other factors, people with high IQs do not have better relationships and better marriages. They are not better at raising their children. In a chapter of Handbook of Intelligence, Richard K. Wagner of Florida State University surveys the research on IQ and job performance and concludes, IQ predicts only about 4% of variance in job performance. In another chapter of the handbook, John D. Mayer, Peter Salovey, and David Caruso conclude that at best, IQ contributes about 20% to life success. There is great uncertainty about these sorts of numbers. As Richard Nisbet puts it, what nature hath joined together, multiple regression cannot put asunder. But the general idea is that once you get past some pretty obvious correlations, smart people make better mathematicians, there is a very loose relationship between IQ and life outcomes. One famous longitudinal study known as the Terman study followed a group of extremely high IQ students. They all scored 135 or above. The researchers expected these brilliant young people to go on to have illustrious careers. They did fine, becoming lawyers and corporate executives for the most part. But there were no superstar achievers in the group, no Pulitzer Prize winners or MacArthur Award winners. In a follow-up study by Melita Oden in 1968, the people in the group who seemed to be doing best had only slightly higher IQs. What they had was superior work ethics. They were the ones who had shown more ambition as children. Once a person crosses the IQ threshold of 120, there is little relationship between more intelligence and better performance. A person with a 150 IQ is, in theory, much smarter than a person with a 120 IQ. But those additional 30 points produce little measurable benefit when it comes to lifetime success. As Malcolm Gladwell demonstrated in Outliers, the Americans who won Nobel Prizes in chemistry and medicine did not mostly go to Harvard and MIT, the schools at the tippy top of the cognitive ladder. It was simply enough that they went to good schools, Rollins College, Washington State, Grinnell. If you are smart enough to get into a good school, you're smart enough to excel. even in academic spheres like chemistry and medical research. It's not important that you are in the top 0.5%. A study of 7,403 Americans who participated in the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, conducted by Jay Zagorski of Ohio State, found no correlation between accumulating large wealth and high IQ. Harrison's mistake was to equate IQ with mental ability. The reality is that intelligence is a piece of mental ability, but it is not the most important piece. People who score well on IQ tests are good at logical, linear, and computational tasks. But to excel in the real world, intelligence has to be nestled in certain character traits and dispositions. To draw a parallel, a soldier may be phenomenally strong. If you gave him a test involving push-ups and pull-ups, he would do very well. But unless he possesses courage, discipline, technique, imagination, and sensitivity, he probably won't survive amidst the chaos of the battlefield. In the same way, a thinker may be very smart, but unless she possesses moral virtues such as honesty, rigor, and fair-mindedness, she probably won't succeed in real life. In his book, What Intelligence Tests Miss, Keith E. Stanovich lists some of the mental dispositions that contribute to real-world performance. The tendency to collect information before making up one's mind, the tendency to seek various points of view before coming to a conclusion, the disposition to think extensively about a problem before responding, the tendency to calibrate the degree of strength of one's opinions to the degree of evidence available, the tendency to think about future consequences before taking action, the tendency to explicitly weight pluses and minuses of a situation before making a decision, and the tendency to seek nuance and avoid absolutism. In other words, there is a big difference between mental force and mental character. Mental character is akin to moral character. It is forged by experience and effort, carved into the hinterland of the mind. Clocks and clouds. The science writer Jonah Lehrer sometimes reminds his readers of Karl Popper's distinctions between clocks and clouds. Clocks are neat, orderly systems that can be defined and evaluated using reductive methodologies. You can take apart a clock, measure the pieces, and see how they fit together. Clouds are irregular, dynamic, and idiosyncratic. It's hard to study a cloud because they change from second to second. They can best be described through narrative, not numbers. As Lehrer has noted, one of the great temptations of modern research is that it tries to pretend that every phenomenon is a clock, which can be evaluated using mechanical tools and regular techniques. This is surely true of the study of intelligence. Researchers have spent a great deal of time studying IQ, which is relatively stable and quantifiable, and relatively little time studying mental character, which is cloud-like. Raw intelligence is useful for helping you solve well-defined problems. Mental character helps you figure out what kind of problem you have in front of you and what sort of rules you should use to address it. As Stanovich notes, if you give people the rules they need to follow in order to solve a thinking problem, then people with higher IQs do better than people with low IQs. But if you don't give them the rules, people with high IQs do no better, because coming up with the rules to solve a problem and honestly evaluating one's performance afterward are mental activities barely related to IQ. Mental force and mental character are only lightly correlated. As Stanovich puts it, many different studies involving thousands of subjects have indicated that measures of intelligence display only moderate to weak correlations, usually less than 0.3, with some thinking dispositions. For example, actively open-minded thinking, need for cognition, and near zero correlation with others, such as conscientiousness, curiosity, diligence. Many investors, for example, are quite intelligent, but behave self-destructively because of their excessive faith in their intelligence. Between 1998 and 2001, the First-Hand Technology Value Mutual Fund produced an annualized total return of 16%. The average individual investor in this fund, however, lost 31.6% of his or her money over this time. Why? Because the geniuses thought they could get in and out of the market at the right moments. They missed the important up days and caught the devastating down ones. These people, who are quite smart, performed worse than if they had been stolid and stupid. Other people score well on IQ tests but can't hold down a job. James J. Heckman of the University of Chicago and others compared the workplace performance of high school graduates with those who dropped out of high school but took the GED exams. The GED recipients are as smart as high school grads who do not go on to college, but they earn less than these high school grads. In fact, they have lower hourly wages than do high school dropouts because they possess fewer of the so-called non-cognitive traits like motivation and self-discipline. GED recipients are much more likely to switch jobs. Their labor force participation rates are lower than that of high school grads. At the very top of intellectual accomplishment, intelligence is nearly useless in separating outstanding geniuses from everybody else. The greatest thinkers seem to possess mental abilities that go beyond rational thinking, narrowly defined. Their abilities are fluid and thoroughly cloud-like. Albert Einstein, for example, would seem to be an exemplar of scientific or mathematical intelligence. But he addressed problems by playing with imaginative, visual, and physical sensations. The words of the language, as they are written or spoken, do not seem to play any role in my mechanism of thought, he told Jacques Hadamard. Instead, he said that his intuitions proceed through certain signs and more or less clear images that he could manipulate and combine. The above-mentioned elements are, in my case, of visual and some of muscular type, Einstein observed. I can only think in pictures, the physicist and chemist Peter Debye declared. It's all visual. He said that when working on a problem, he saw fuzzy images, which he tried to progressively clarify in his mind, and then eventually, after the problem was largely solved, he would clarify the pictures in the form of mathematics. Others proceed acoustically, rehearsing certain sounds associated with certain ideas. Others do so emotionally. You had to use your feelings, Debye explained. What does the carbon atom want to do? Wisdom doesn't consist of knowing specific facts or possessing knowledge of a field. It consists of knowing how to treat knowledge, being confident but not too confident, adventurous but grounded. It is a willingness to confront counter-evidence and to have a feel for the vast spaces beyond what's known. Harrison did not rate highly on any of these character traits.